Okay, well, welcome everyone. I would like to start by acknowledging with gratitude that we are meeting on the traditional unceded territory or lands of the Coast Salish people, and particularly the Qualicum First Nation. I think I forgot to do that last time. I was a little tired, so I didn't want to forget this time, because definitely that acknowledgement is important. So we'll start with adoption of the agenda. I'm looking for someone to move adoption. Anyone? Greg?
Yep.
And Doug seconding. Thank you. All those in favor? Great. So the agenda is adopted. And then approval of the minutes. We need a mover again. Lena, thank you. And the seconder, that was Doug. Did I see a wave? Okay, great. So all those in favor? Great, thank you. So that's done. Business arising from the minutes. So the last time we met, we had the presentations from the RDN on the watershed management. And so I didn't... We didn't hear from any of the committee members whether you had any thoughts about priorities or where we wanted to go with that. I guess one of my number one things has been, and it is on the list already in the climate change adaptation plan, and that is the purchase or securing of Hamilton Marsh. And I think that that's an important one for this area. My understanding is that it helps to feed the Berwick well field. Is that correct, Bob?
No, not from what we understand of the boundaries of our well field. I think the recharge areas are mostly north of the highway. I mean, we haven't gone that far afield, but as far as all the modeling done by Alan Bacon, he shows aquifer boundaries, but they're on this side of the highway. So I mean, it's really tributary to French Creek. So I don't know that it may recharge the aquifer, but he doesn't define the boundaries as being that far over.
Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying that.
Yes. And I don't know, like you asked me for information on the water conservation initiative or water conservation generally in town here after last meeting.
Well, I think you had said there was a couple of documents that you had in mind that you might share with the committee to help.
Yep. And I grabbed those and thrown them in a bit of a PowerPoint presentation whenever you want to see that.
Okay. Well, when we move on to the next one, I think that's the number four is dealing with objective six, and that's the topic for today. So I just wondered if anybody else had anything else coming from last time. Or I guess we can always throw our recommendations in at the end when we're contemplating which motions or recommendations we want to forward to council generally. The one thing that came to mind for me perhaps is building some more partnerships around the watershed management. I know there's other organizations that are out there that are interested or invested in watersheds, like there is the Arrowsmith Brown Water Alliance. There's also an organization on the island, Partnership for Water Sustainability in BC. I just wondered if maybe we want to look at some of those other, organizations that have some of the expertise in those areas and may be good partners for the town going forward. And then my other thing is always promoting tap water. Qualicum Beach has high quality, good tasting water. You know, why don't we really let that be known? Especially, when people are coming and staying in hotels, sometimes you turn to bottled water because you don't know if the water is safe to drink or it might cause you problems or whatever. But I think there we are. Always on tap. And we did have the tap water at the family day over the weekend, and the Groundwater Alliance people were there promoting it. I think we could have maybe done a little bit better job letting people know it was there and it was available. But I think as they come out and we do this more often, then people will get used to it being there and we'll go and drink the tap water rather than purchasing bottled water at special events. So we're on tap again for Beach Day, I understand. So that's great. Does anybody have any further comments about the discussion on watersheds? Doug?
Yeah, it wasn't when Bob held up that. Well, that's a refillable water bottle, isn't it?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, and it says Qualicum Beach Water is good. Is that what it says? I can't really see it.
Always on tap.
Yes, yeah, I was unaware that we even had those, and I think that's great. I'm a big booster of our town quality water here for many years. I lived in Vancouver, and I had to boil my water. It didn't work well for me, but since moving to Qualicum Beach, I drink water out of the tap all the time, and I'm really grateful and appreciative of the high-quality water we have. I visit my friends down in Columbia Beach, and if we go to dinner there, I fill my refillable water bottle with Qualicum Beach water and drink that instead. It looks a little funny having the plastic water bottle on the table when everybody else is drinking out of the glass, but that stuff is horrible compared to ours. So I really appreciate the high-quality water we have here, and agree with Ann's idea that we should do more to promote it as an alternative to bottled water.
Well, I drafted a couple of recommendations, so I'll put those forward at the end when we're having, when we're mulling over all of our topics and where we want to go with those. So I'm happy to do that. Okay, so welcome, David, to the meeting. Glad you could join us. Are you able to unmute? Okay.
Yeah.
We have been having problems with that, so I just wanted to make sure that you could.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Good.
I'm a little chagrined.
Okay. Okay. Well, then we'll move on to item 4 and Bob's presentation. Looking forward to it. Thank you, Bob.
Okay. See if this works.
And Bob, I just want to share you to make those co-hosts.
So this is on objective number 6, increase water conservation practices and policies.
Yeah.
Correct? Yeah.
So,
hey, Ben.
Hi.
Ben has just joined us.
Oh, good.
You're back on. Do you want to sit there so that and the owl will catch you?
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Bob's just leaving with the presentation.
Okay.
Does that come up?
It is, yeah.
Okay, so interestingly enough, I went looking back through some old documents. I'm going to put something new together, but I found this report that was done in 2011, and it was amazingly spot on for like what the initiatives, you know, what the initiatives we'd identified we are still doing, and you know, can sort of report on some of the progress work. So this was done in 2011, so it shows that we've been on this file for quite a while now, and the greatest achievement we've had is we've had a reduction of the maximum day demand from 3.29 meters cubed per capita per day to a value of 1.5, and that was in 2011. We have since dropped that 1.5, last year 1.23, and it was a heavy use year because of the heat dome. So it's not even realistic of where our maximum day demand and our production is going. I'll show figures on that later. So we'll go down. So it's prior to 1980, the per capita max day demand was 1.18 meters cubed per capita per day, and it principally limited by system capacity. Then the major water system improvements were done in the late 70s, early 80s, and water consumption reached a peak of 3.29 by 1985. The town's water study of 87 identified that we were more than double the average per capita use of municipalities around us and recommended we do something within the next 10 years before we exceeded all our improvement capacity. So our planning goals were, because we're beyond acceptable levels, water consumption in line with regionally accepted values. We want to see sustainable management of the town's water resources, and we want to see recovery of water production costs from water revenue. So these are the basic conservation initiatives. What struck me is we haven't really left anything from this list off, and we're still doing it. We have sprinkling restrictions. They've varied over time, but I'm happy with the way they are now, although people say we should be more brutal with them. But my point is we shouldn't be putting water on anything when the sun is up. And that's what our restrictions represent, 7 at night till 7 in the morning. So we lose no water to evaporation. The water rate bylaws needed amending. They were counterproductive for trying to conserve water, and you'll see those charts in a minute. So all those years we changed our water rate bylaw. In the early years we were distributing, you know, low flow devices, but I think that now the industry has responded, and just about every appliance in your house uses way less water than it did in this time. Education, the Team Water Smart, we still belong and fund that function that's run by the regional district. I think the girls, they do a great job, and they set up at most of our major events with a booth to do education, and they have some great programs that they will actually come and do things like irrigation systems audits on your house and tell you how to more properly set up your controller, maybe things you could change, heads that are outdated. They do a great job of that stuff. We looked at our own open space management of water use and municipal parks and public spaces. We have made amendments to some of that. And the biggest thing that I think we're seeing now is all of our green spaces, we're going to a drip irrigation system as opposed to spray and broadcast like it was back in the old days. We looked at excessive use consumers. At one point, the curling rink had used water for condenser cooling and then just dumped it in the ditch. So, you know, we've gone after heavy water wasters like that and changed it. Talk about irrigation retrofitting. We feed information from the weather station into our computer controls for irrigation. We have a lot more of that now. Water control, loss control, the night irrigation I talked about, hanging basket liners. Interesting, this time, if you look down at the new streetlight posts in East Village, they have little water feeding lines that come out on their hanging basket arms, and there's a controller in the kiosk down there that just like will feed, you know, the baskets the appropriate amount of water, so we don't have to go around with a truck and keep watering them. We've done soil amendments in some of our green spaces, so we lose less water. We replaced all the water meters, so we know that they're accurate and not leaking. And we changed the billing periods from six months to 5 and 7 months, and that better captures the high flow period of like May, June, July, August, September. And it also evens out the bills a bit because your summer bill is always high and your winter bill is always low. So the winter period is a little bit longer, summer period is shorter. That's the kind of the pattern of use over the years. So you can see that, you know, your heavy use is May, June, July, August, and September, and pretty flat through the winter time. Future conservation initiatives, to continue with Team WaterSmart, and we have. This is an 11-year-old report, and we're still doing it, and I think they're very effective. The communities in Bloomfield there isn't very relevant anymore because we've sort of dropped that program. The sewer use rates bylaw changed from a flat rate to basing it on your winter water use, which I think is representative, because in the wintertime, everything that basically comes into your house as water goes out as sewer. So we just take the winter consumption, double it, and so you're paying your sewer on what you're actually putting into the sewer. So we thought that was a good initiative. Council commits regular amendments to water rates bylaw. You'll see this chart in a minute. and continue amendment to sprinkling restrictions. I don't know. There may be pressure to reduce our sprinkling restrictions, but I think what we've done with the water rates bylaw is we penalize excessive use. And you know, the best way we found to get people to pay attention is to talk to their pocketbook. And I think that's what we've had. We've had great success in having our total consumption fall, even with increasing population, and our max day demand has dropped way off. So, just engineering points there. I think I spoke into these. We have more and more computerized control of the irrigation systems, expanded drip, and expanded use of native plant and zero staking. So here's a history of our water rates bylaws. So the chart here, like the vertical axis is obviously cost per cubic meter. And then it goes out, level of consumption is on horizontal, and then it shows the years stacked up as we go into the depth of field. So in the old days, like in 77, the city fathers felt that it didn't cost the town more to produce more water. So it should get cheaper as you use more. And like, that's an absolute disincentive to water conservation. And it was like in 1985 that we had that 3.29 cubic meters per capita per day water usage. So even before I worked for the town, I was consulting, and we tried to get the town to correct this, and it took some time to convince them. So we gradually made them raise it, try and get to a flat rate, and then start to increase the heavy consumption. So you can see that as the years have gone on, we've moved those categories down in the consumption level. So you more quickly step up to a higher rate, and if you really want to consume water, you're stepping up to a very high rate. So that's the history of our water rates, and I think this tool has been the most effective tool in seeing our consumption come down. Maybe it's a little busy for most people, but I just think it's a good representation because you can totally see the trend that we've taken. So there's historical annual water production and trend. So it continues to fall. It has fallen 20%, while at the same time the population from 2004 to now has increased 13%. So, that's doubly good because we're getting more people and we're producing less water. So these are just this is sort of reflects the health of our well field. This is an annual trace. So this is the statistical data over the year, the last 10-year period for the Berwick well field. So you can see like during the winter time it recharges, and May when we start to turn the well field on and use it for summer peaking, we draw it down and then it starts to recharge again. The blue are the maximum and minimum values on any given day over the last 10 years. The green is the average. The blue and the red are us this year. So you can see with our really cool spring and no summer yet, we're going to set like a historic high water levels in Berwick with our red level trend breaking out of the barrier there. So that's good news. And this is we have two well fields. We have the Berwick well field and the River well field. The river well field is in the delta of the Little Qualicum River, so it's very well recharged by the river, and that water goes tidal, like right after it passes our well. So that's we're not having a huge environmental impact by drawing out of that aquifer. But in the summertime, when the river's down a little bit, we try and sort of be respectful to our neighbors around there and not draw too hard on us. So we use the Berwick aquifer in the summertime to meet our peaking demands. And we think that we're operating in a sustainable way. And as you can see, we're about to set a new maximum water level for this day, which is, that's great news when a lot of the aquifers around us are known to be in decline. So this is historical data. So it sort of shows, in the beginning that was dropping a bit. We're mining water, and then we developed the river well field. We had a boil water order where we had to go back on Berwick to get exclusively, and then we got ourselves back into a recharge position. And now we're sort of up at perhaps a typical sustainable maximum level. This is the river well field, and you can see like it's very much reflects the levels that are in the river. During high discharge times of year, the water level is high, and then the summer falls off of it. But again, we're in good shape there. There's the annual trace for it, or the historical traces for it. And what's interesting here is you see back in around 2012 and stuff, they weren't using the storage that exists on the top of Cameron Lake the same way that they're using the storage in the Englishman River in Arrowsmith, the Arrowsmith Dam. Arrowsmith Dam releases water every day to support fishery stocks and to support the municipal withdrawals. But what they found was that the fish stocks came racing back. They're fantastic because of the increase in the habitat. The fish stocks are really, really recovering. So fisheries looked at this, and because they've been using the storage in Cameron Lake for two pulse withdrawals. They would pulse it in June to clean out spawning channels, and they would pulse it in the fall to draw fish up to the hatchery. And they looked at this. They did a few improvements to get a little extra storage on the top of Cameron Lake, and now they release daily because they're looking for that fisheries benefit and the whole stand. And what you can see is like the minimum levels have come up. So over the for the period 2016 and beyond, we can see that the minimum water levels coming up in that aquifer. That's good news too. And that's it. So do I have to what do I have to do to get rid of my screen for you, for me?
Just say stop sharing, or I can take it back. No, I think you just said me say stop sharing.
Stop share. Questions?
No questions here, Bob. I just think that's really impressive that you've had such a per capita decline, in water consumption over the years. But looks like just staying the course going forward is probably a good thing.
I was happy to find that old document, and I was going to start to revise it. And I thought, we should just use this document because it still reflects everything we're doing, and we can sort of report on how we've done. I think it's mm-hmm. a good indication that we've been, on this file since 2011 and even previous to that.
And Bob, I've got a quick question. It's like Don says we're going to have more heat domes and that sort of thing. Do you see any change in the allowable daily watering? Because I found it peculiar last summer going through that heat dome that my neighbor was still watering. He's still allowed to water every single day, whereas you go to a different municipality within the RDN and they have a bit stricter bylaws.
They do have stricter bylaws, but the craziest thing about their watering restrictions is they still allow people to water during the day. And probably half the water that they're pouring onto their garden or lawn is just lost to evaporation. So yes, they're more limiting, but I think there's less logic to it. And to me, even with the heat dome, if you water at night, you're not, you're going to be losing some of it because it's an awful lot hotter, but you can protect your garden. And, like I say, we've chosen to hit high consumers in the pocketbook. And I think what we're finding is most people, especially people who have concern for the environment and everything else, aren't those kind of excessive water users. So I still defend our watering restrictions. And what we found in the past and what I found working in other municipalities, if you tell somebody you can only water between this time and this time, well, everybody is out there because, God damn it, I got to get out there and get my water, or I'm not going to get it. So we have different incentives and disincentives. And I don't know. We'll see where the politicians go with it, but I still defend it as a water use policy.
What of because I know the RDN has that stage 4 that they go to where watering your grass or washing your car is not allowed. Do we go to that, or are we kind of exempt from that sort of water policy?
The thing is that, you know, like our maximum water production, like back in the day was probably, you know, I don't know, 15, I can't remember what it is, 15,000 cubic meters a day or something. Well, we're now at like our max is like about 10. So we're down a third from what we were. We still have lots of water. I mean, we have sufficient water to be able to comfortably go to council and say, you know what, you could help and make a deal with the Oriental supply sandpiper and not stress your system. So, I mean, if we got lots of water, you know, can you turn around and tell the people, no, you can't use it? You just make it expensive for them to use.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with how much our water just dropped per capita. That's awesome. But I just think, like, we're viewing this non-renewable resource as a single entity that's only within our own community. When those aquifers, you know, I don't know the map of the aquifers, but it's a regional system, right? So the more that we use, the more potential that, you know, it's less water is getting to our neighbor's aquifer. That's outside of our, you know, jurisdiction, but is also going to impact the broader region.
Well, I think if you look at that historic trace of the Berwick aquifer, it's at historic highs. Like, you know, and it's important that, like, it's when it spills naturally, it's the base flows to Beach Creek. And I think as we've seen that aquifer come up, we're getting more natural spill. So, I mean, we think we're operating that sustainably, and it's coming up. Like, the river well field is a bit different because, like I say, if we don't take that water, it goes tidal. So, you know, we're not having a huge impact on the environment there. And we're blessed with the resource we have. And, you know, it's a question of, like, how comfortable are the politicians telling somebody you can't use it? If we show that we can operate it sustainably.
Yeah. So anyway, Doug, go ahead. You're muted, Doug.
Thank you. There we go. Yeah, just share a perspective. My wife and I grow a big, well, mostly she does, grows a big vegetable garden. And we really value the opportunity to do that. And we feel that that's a good thing, so to speak, environmentally, because the food you grow yourself doesn't have to be produced elsewhere and trucked elsewhere. But we use water to do that. And our water, we own two houses in Quality Beach, one we live in and one we rent. And the one we rent, they don't grow any food, and they use about the same amount of water as us. So we don't feel we're being wasteful by doing that. But I had an interesting experience. A friend came by and admiring my wife's tomatoes, and he says, I can't grow tomatoes like that. My wife won't let me water them because we shouldn't waste water. And I thought, that's carrying the philosophy of conserving water beyond a point that makes sense. Because as Bob was saying, that a lot of that water that's in the little Qualicum Reservoir or Welsh aquifer right next to the ocean, if we don't draw it out, it simply goes out the river. And we're using it sustainably. And so for him to say, I have to buy tomatoes from California rather than grow my own because I don't want to waste water, it just doesn't make any sense. So I appreciate the way water's being managed in this community. I don't mind paying the rate that we're paying. I think it's fair and reasonable for the excellent quality water we get. And I think it's good to conserve water, but it, like, you know, it was mentioned washing your car and watering your lawn. So we don't water our lawn. Although if you go by our property right now, you see we have sprinklers set up because we started a new lawn, and that's only for this summer. I want to assure you we won't be watered in the summer once it's established. But so we really appreciate the opportunity to use water to grow food. And it's kind of wasteful, of course, using that beautiful filtered chlorinated water for that, but that's what's available to us, so that's what we use.
I'll just make one more comment then. You know, the other thing is, like, part of the strategy, the council strategy was recover the cost of producing water with water rates. So, you know, if you start to use less water, you're selling less use, you have to make up for that, like, with increased cost. And, you know, to the point of, like, do we get very restrictive with people and tell them how much they can use? Well, you can, but like you're going to have to recover the money somewhere. So you say, well, you can use, you have to use less water because we tell you, and oh, by the way, we're going to charge you less water. Like at some point, those two lines are not going to cross and very well. Anyway, just my perspective.
Wow, I'm so sorry about
this
commuting business.
Okay, there we go. Thank you. Does anybody else have any more questions? I just had a couple of things that I thought of prior to the meeting, so prior to Bob's presentation. But one of the ones was more around, I guess, food growing, agriculture. And I had participated in a session that was run by Forward Nanaimo 22. So it's a group that's trying to get progressive thinking candidates running in the election. And one of the presentations was about food security. And there was a farmer from the Comox Valley. And what they had done was basically made a holding pond, so that they would be able to store water that falls in the winter and spring months, fall, winter, spring, and use it during the summer months. And I think, you know, farms traditionally have done that, but is that something that would work in Qualicum Beach, or is there concerns about doing that kind of thing? And I know, it's also been talked about that Qualicum Beach could or should maybe have a supply of water that could be used in the case of extreme forest fire, or if a helicopter had to come and use a bucket to grab water. Anyways, just some thinking there, Bob. Do you have any comments about any of that?
Well, a couple of things, and you might not know this, but we hold one reservoir offline from any distribution system, so that in the case of some kind of emergency or earthquake, we break the water lines and drain all these reservoirs, we have one reservoir that sits offline that can be used for emergency purposes. We just transfer water into it from Berwick, and then we pump it into the High Jones Reservoir. So it's always refreshed, and it's sort of a legacy of when Uptown had two different pressure zones, and after the QF fire, we realized that we had to make it one pressure zone for the firefighting capability. So the reservoir kind of became redundant for its top water level. So we just used it in this capacity to always have some emergency water. Now, we don't have anything big enough for a bandy bucket to duck into, but it does ensure that we have one reservoir always sitting that won't be drained by a distribution system. So, I mean, that's kind of a nice resilient feature of our water system as well. As far as can we store water and in the winter and use it in the summer? The problem with our climate is we have a wet season and we have a dry season. So all the water falls at one time, and then we have a long period of time when we sort of need it. And it takes a lot of storage for anybody to try and do that. So like rainwater barrels and things like that, they're useful at the shoulder seasons, but they're not necessarily the answer for us to sort of store water for use in the summertime. Like to me, the absolute best use of the rainwater barrel is to collect your rainwater during the storm, keep it on your property, and just like release it through some kind of tiny orifice over the next several days or week, and just let it sort of soak into the ground and become part of the recharge and interflow that goes and feeds natural systems and stays out of the ditches, stops erosion, never enters the stormwater system. Like, to me, that's the greatest thing we could do with rain barrels in our climate. So, anyway, there's, I got up my soapbox.
Okay, well, I guess my other comment was, I think somebody had also made mention of this, is that we use our good quality water to do everything. So from flushing toilets to washing cars to whatever, right? So the consideration about the use of gray water or a system that would adapt to that in the future, should we need to go that route? Any thoughts?
The issue, health issue with that is they don't think there's anything as gray water. There's black water.
Okay.
So that's kind of their position. And as far as like the cost for us to treat it, we don't run it through a very expensive top-grade treatment plant. We run it through an ultraviolet reactor that does 100% of our disinfection requirements. And we only put a tiny bit of chlorine in for like a system residual. So like our treatment costs are pretty minor compared to trying to build a parallel system to run black water. You know, I mean, there's things that can be done in the house, if you want to use certain water for functions, you know, shower water to flush your toilet or things. I mean, you can retrofit it. It makes health nervous. They're always worried about the cross-contamination and things like that, so.
Yeah. Okay, and I guess the only other thought that I had was, in future, water is going to be probably the number one commodity. And could there be decisions being made outside, like on a more regional basis, that would impact the town? And is there anything that we could do to prepare for that?
Like the biggest one for me locally is that top storage on Cameron Lake. It's currently a non-consumptive storage license owned by Fisheries. Before the Arrowsmith Water Service and building the Arrowsmith Dam, we had made an application for storage on top of Cameron Lake, and it was denied, and I was made to withdraw it, because they said that they couldn't raise Cameron Lake anymore because of the elevation of the highway. Then they turned around a couple of years later and gave it to Fisheries. And I cried foul and said, you wouldn't let me have it, but you gave it to them. So it was the same problems exist. So I'm on record as having, with water management, saying, like, if there's a consumptive portion of that license and a non-consumptive portion. Fisheries use is non-consumptive. And I said that I wanted first right to the consumption portion of that license if it came to that. And we really don't need a surface water source, but we do want to see the continued release of that water to sort of like recharge the aquifer and the delta the way they're doing now. That suits us perfectly well. And what I'm terribly concerned about is the consumptive portion of that license falling into the hands of somebody like EPCOR or, other developments in the regional district. That would be my greatest fear.
So it sounds like you've done what you can in order to try to mitigate that happening.
I'm an a-hole everywhere.
Okay, David, we'll just move on from that, Bob.
Yeah, Bob, I just wonder if there is any kind of forward projection in terms of, given our current water use, and we seem to have a fairly good handle on that, exactly what kind of population, given our current use, and maybe even figuring into that hotter temperatures in the future, but is there any kind of thinking of projecting into, let's say, over the next 20 years or so in terms of what the needs of the community might be?
Well, certainly, like we reviewed the OCP build-out, water use, even at the current levels, not even assuming that we continue to sort of make progress on the per capita consumption. But we looked at the OCP build-out and presented that information to council when we were considering the sandpaper bulk water supply. And we can easily supply our OCP build-out. Like our OCP build-out isn't even as much as our historic maximum consumption. So, I tend to think that we're in pretty good shape. And we've got two wells that we haven't even commissioned and brought online.
Right.
We've got a well in the River Well Field. We couldn't even accurately rate it because we didn't have pumps and piping to take the water away fast enough to try and give it a rating, get it a drawdown rating. So we've got a pretty amazing source.
Thank you.
Anyone else have any questions? Any more questions for Bob? I just had one. No, that's it's quite significant. I mean, you've mentioned a few things, like the fact that we're charging more for water, some of those low-flow things that happened over time. But is there specific things or number one things that you think have impacted taking that consumption down from 3.29 to 1.23?
Well, I think you can draw a pretty straight line to the water rates bylaws, and the improvement in water use. All appliances are better. Irrigation practices are getting better. More people are using drip rather than sprinklers and spray. You know, everything is trending in the right direction. You know, I think the world is learning and we're doing a better job. And you know, those are all good things for us.
So it's more of a cumulative thing rather than just one specific.
Yeah, I don't think it's one big thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, personally, I think this is one of the areas that it's a priority, but it doesn't need to be. You know, I think it's something that I feel quite comfortable about and that, you know, that the town has well in hand compared to maybe some of the other issues that we're looking at in relation to the climate change adaptation plan.
Yeah. I mean, the only other sort of thing that's always in my mind as far as, like, you know, when we talk about sprinkling restrictions and how much water can you use and we're going to have increasing heat zones and stuff, like the wildfire aspect of, like, you know, how dry do we let everything get before everything starts catching on fire? Like, we have quite a few fires now in the walking trails, and there's always, like, a bunch of them in summer time, so we tossed the flooded some park mulch, and you know, I think if we absolutely dried everything out, we'd probably get more of that. You know, I think we need to be fire smart, but you know, where is me at that? Where I see everything gets super dry.
We all do. David.
Yeah. Bob, do you see any benefit in a bit of a public education program to acquaint the public just in terms of where the aquifers are and having them posted? I know some communities that I've seen over the years, you know, will have signage like, you know, you're walking on your aquifer, this kind of thing. Giving people an idea of what is under their feet and also the value of it. And I'm thinking in terms of you know, things like soil contamination and so on and so forth and use of chemicals. Maybe that kind of an awareness might not go amiss.
Yes, I've seen those signs. I think what we've done or undertaken as a town is we've tried to identify, you know, the really susceptible areas around our wellheads and secure them in, under town ownership. That's sort of the first thing you can do is, like, you know, you get control of it. And you know, the one aspect that people might not know about, like, say, the River Wellfield, the Laverne Road goes across the River Wellfield. And it was considered a great risk to have a fuel spill or something that could contaminate it. Well, if you go down Laverne Road, you might notice that all of the barriers, the New Jersey barriers down the side of the road, they're actually paved right into the roadway. Mm-hmm. And they're intended to collect any spill and direct it to that pond off the side. That pond is rubber lined and has submerged outlets. So if there was ever a spill, it would be collected, go into that pond, and you could recover it before it could contaminate anything. So that's an initiative we took, you know, considering
right.
The aquifer. Nothing like that has ever happened. And that what was called the contaminant pond in the construction drawings has become one of the best pieces of habitat on the whole alignment. It's when the biologist was doing his big amphibian surveys, he'd gather up everything he had and he put it in the pond there because it was the best piece of habitat for them to survive. So that's just a little mm-hmm. side. But yeah, we're concerned about it. But you know, in most cases, You know, the worst thing we've got is dog walkers, really. And, you know, they walk in those places so they don't have to pick it up, and I don't think it's science for
them. Right.
Good point. Anyone else? Go once. Point twice. No. Okay. So that's great. Thank you, Bob, for sharing your wealth of knowledge. I think we all learned a thing or two today, so thank you very much. Number five was status of recommendations to council, so I don't think we have anything going forward. We will once we finish this review. New business, not that I know of. And then future agenda items and discussion. So when I looked at the list of objectives that we were reviewing, number seven was to manage invasive species throughout the community, and we felt that that was fairly well in hand, that there was programs and awareness around that, and not maybe a lot that this committee would contribute to that item. The eighth was improve public health, safety, and preparedness to climate-related events. I think we talked at one point, Luke, and you might correct me, about perhaps having the emergency management people come in and talk to us about that. But I didn't have it checked off as one of our items. And then number nine was integrate climate change thinking into future planning. So that's a big one. And that would be, my understanding is, our topic for the next meeting. Luke, do I have that right? Or, oh, yes. Doug, did you have a question about that just before I turn it over to Luke?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yes. Excuse me. This is referring back to the one about public health you just mentioned.
Yes.
I just bring it to your attention, to everybody's attention, that there was a report recently released. It's called Irreversible Extreme Heat, Protecting Canadians and Communities from a Lethal Future by the University of Waterloo Intact Center on Climate Adaptation. And I think it would be very useful for us to review that report and distill some recommendations out of that that would feed back into that question about preparedness for health impacts of climate change, particularly extreme heat events. I think it's a really useful report. It talks about what individuals can do and institutions and communities. So I just put that on the agenda following up to what you said about looking at that action item on the climate adaptation plan.
Okay. Do you have the link for that, Doug, that you would be able to share or with us, or for the next meeting? Or
okay, I'll see if I can find it and stick it in the chat.
Okay.
I downloaded the document itself, but I'd have to re-find the link to it. It should take me a moment, but I think I can do that.
Sounds like a good report. It would be very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry if I interrupted there.
Nope, that's all good. So with that information, Luke, do you chime in?
Yes. Thanks, Councilor Skipsy. I agree that Objective 9, integrating climate change thinking into future planning, would be the next step. I also agree that it'd be nice to have a discussion about public health, safety, preparedness, and maybe involving the emergency program at some point. There's some, like, the current emergency preparedness coordinator is not available. So I think we'll just have to put that to the side of it and maybe come back to it at the time when, you know, staff is available to come and make that sort of a delegation. Similarly, staff at the RDN has had some, RDN and Parksville, there's some changes, so I think at the appropriate time we should bring that back and discuss it as a group, but it wouldn't be in the near future. So let's go ahead and queue up the climate change thinking into future planning.
for the next one. You'd note that there's a really broad range of actions identified under there. So just for everyone's benefit, if you don't have it in front of you, it involves youth engagement, promoting the outcome of this climate adaptation plan and project, in exploring opportunities for town staff and how they can implement climate-related initiatives, and then exploring the mental health implications associated with climate change and what that would mean for our community. So when we talk about how climate change thinking is actually integrated, it's a very broad discussion. So I think it's going to be an interesting one next week or next meeting. And we're not limited to these things either. It's more of a philosophical discussion about what it would mean if we actually integrated climate change thinking into our planning. So I'll turn it back to you, Councillor Skipsey, but just setting the framework for next discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that sounds really interesting. I think that'll be a great conversation. And the next meeting is scheduled for June 20th. And hopefully everyone will be able to attend. I know that's getting close to the end of the school year, but hopefully that works for people. Yeah, okay, great. So we'll have that discussion then on Objective 9. If you look at it in the climate change adaptation plan, just have a look and see where that discussion may go. Okay, so and then the other thing that didn't make it back in time for this agenda, and I'm not sure, Luke, where we're going to be with that, but council did decide to refer back the Urban Forest Master Plan to the committee for input on what our top two priorities would be, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, just to clarify that, don't worry, they're not referring the whole plan back to you. It has essentially moved forward and council has received it, so that part is done. But the big question now is, what do we do with this plan? And that's the item that council's referred back to you. So I think we're going to work through this climate adaptation material first, but then you do have a full workload for the foreseeable future. So I hope you're not making any plans.
Okay. Great. Thank you. So does anyone have any last comments for today? Anything that we talked about or anything coming up? No. A quiet bunch. Okay. Well, then I guess we need someone to move adjournment, please. Oh, David? Seconder? Greg? Okay. Thank you, everyone.